and good morning or good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Priscilla Henley. I am the Vice President of Access HR. Access HR has over 25 years of experience of being an HR-focused employee benefits firm with over 500 clients, and we have access to all the U.S. carriers and markets. Our high level of intimacy with presenting options for cost savings coupled with our service has been very unique and has been at the forefront of U.S. administrating employee benefits for our clients. As our U.S. companies have continued to expand internationally, HR can experience challenges that may include compliance, recruiting, retention, employee complaints, cost concerns, and difficulty obtaining credible information regarding competitive benefits practices with their affiliates throughout the world. So we have joined forces with Globex, who has been a great partner to be able to offer that expertise and service to our current clients. I'm going to pass it on to Valentin, who is a senior consultant for international benefits with Globex. Valentin?
Yeah, thank you very much, Priscilla. Globex International is an international benefits and property and casualty firm. And we work with this selected number of partner brokers around the United States. And Access HR is one of our partners, a great partner. And that's just one facet that we are doing today in talking about the subject of data privacy and data governance internationally, but our core benefits expertise lay with the subject of international benefits for the local nationals and expatriate type of programs. And the webinar that we're having today is possible due to the knowledge and expertise of our friends from Fifth Step, the consultancy firm that helps organizations around the world to deal with the issues of privacy and data governance. And without further ado, I would like to introduce the CEO of that firm, Darren Ray, who will take on the presentation from that moment on.
Thank you very much, guys. That's a great introduction, and it's a pleasure to be here today talking about the important aspects of data privacy. I'll try and keep my American pronunciation going. So data privacy and data protection is the key things that we're going to be talking about. So a couple of pieces of housekeeping and the objectives that we've got today. We're going to be talking about data privacy and data protection around the world, and we're going to highlight some of the key differences between the requirements in the US, the European Union, Latin America, and Asia Pacific. We're going to talk about what GDPR is and how it may affect your business. We're also going to talk about the actions you may need to take in preparing for GDPR. As I said, we're going to record this webinar, so it will be available after the event. So if you if you've got colleagues who didn't manage to get here today, then they'll be able to download it from our YouTube channel and as a podcast as well. If you do have any questions during the course of the presentation, then do please just ask them within the webinar application, and I'll try and answer them as we go along. If not, we'll get to those at the end. So here we are with a high-level picture of what data privacy looks like around the world, and this is a high-level picture. There are greater granularity to this picture, but this gives you some of the high-level requirements and crossover between the various regulation around the world. So let's start with Argentina. Argentina actually has some relatively good data protection and data privacy requirements. It's one of the countries that has been recognized by the European Union as having GDPR equivalency, which is quite good. It does have some slight differences, and I've summarized those on this infographic type slide here, identifying all the different ones that require a CISO or a data protection officer. So a CISO, for those who are not familiar with that term, is a chief information security officer. That's usually the executive who is responsible for information security within an organization. And a data protection officer is the person who's responsible for the data protection. And very often organizations who have a CISO, they may have their data protection officer, the CISO and the DPO are the same person. Some organizations will have both roles represented though. So in Argentina, we recognize, or they recognize personal data, and the concept of personal data we'll talk about in more depth as we go through these slides. They don't recognize quite so much the need for consent, and we will talk about the importance of that as we go through, and they don't have breach notification at this point. They're also not geo-sensitive, meaning that they the requirements to keep data in one particular country or not to export the data are not in place for Argentina. Talking about Canada, the next, there's no requirement for a CISO or a DPO, as you can see. They do have recognition of at least some aspects of personal data. Now in Canada, it's really the regulation is really focused around anti-spam regulation. So it's important that you differentiate as we look at these things that not all data protection is equal. There is a recognition of consent. It's consent around emailing and not spamming people. And there is a necessity to have a breach notification. So letting people know that there has been a breach that's taken place and doing so in a timely fashion. There isn't geo-sensitivity though. The data can be exported around the world. In the United States, there are a number of pieces of regulation that are now in place. Regulations such as HIPAA and COPPA and COPPA, and also if you're in the financial services sector and you're regulated in New York, there's also the NYCRR 500 requirement, which is a cyber security requirement enforced by the New York Department of Financial Services. Now, some of those require a CISO or a data protection officer, certainly in the case of NYCRR 500. It's very snappily named, I'm sure you'll agree. They also have the concept of personal data requirements, particularly in the case of HIPAA, where you're talking about medical information and ensuring that that is not shared and it's only used for the purpose for which it's collected. There's no guaranteed consent requirements in the United States at this point in time. But depending on the regulation that you are adhering to, there is a breach notification. In the case of NYCRR 500, that's a 72-hour window. I'm not quite sure how Equifax would have been dealing with that if they'd been regulated by the New York Department of Financial Services. There is not geo-sensitivity, so the data can be exported as long as it's being used for the correct purpose. I'm going to cover GDPR or the European regulation just at a higher level because we will talk about that in a little bit more detail as we go through. But there is a requirement for a CISO or a data protection officer. There is a concept of personal data. You do need to have consent for the use of data. Now, consent means that the data subject or the person providing the data has to say that the data can be used for a particular purpose. And there is also a breach notification requirement. And there is geo-sensitivity, meaning that the data belonging to European residents must be treated in a particular way, irrespective of where the data is collected or processed around the world. Moving on to Russia next, there's not a CISO or DPO requirement. There is some concept of personal data. It's not as expansive as in other countries, but there is also a consent requirement, a breach notification, and some geo-sensitivity as well. The geo-sensitivity is that Russian citizen data, actually I think it is actually Russian resident data, must be kept within Russia, so it can't be exported to the United States or things like that. do you know, I've just read out that one, and that's actually China. The Russian one is the next one. Get my flags mixed up there as we move across. So the Russian one is actually CISO, no CISO requirement, personal data defined, consent required, and the geo-sensitivity. And then we move towards the Asia Pacific with Australia being used as an example here. So there is a need for the CISO or DPO, and personal data is required. It's a quite a strong definition of personal data. Also the requirement for consent and breach notification. But there is no geo-sensitivity. So the data belonging to Australian residents can be shipped around the world and can be stored and processed on servers in the United States or in Europe or in China for that matter. There are no requirements on that. Okay, there are a number of countries who are recognised by the European Union as providing adequate protection. Now, with the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, there are three types of country that are defined. There are first countries, so those are countries within the European Union. There are second countries, those who provide adequate protection. And there are third countries. And third countries are those countries that do not provide adequate protection and they are not part of the European Union. So these countries listed, and I won't read them out, I'm sure you guys can all read them on the presentation, although for the benefit of our podcast recording, I guess I ought to read out at least a couple of them, but countries like Andorra, Argentina, I already mentioned, Canada is included, but only for commercial organizations, Faroe Islands, Guernsey, Israel, the Isle of Man, Jersey, New Zealand, Switzerland, Uruguay, and the United States is listed there, but only if the organization has registered with the EU-US Privacy Shield. Okay, so that's an extra piece of regulation that a US company needs to follow, and that enables them to be held legally accountable for the protection of data within the United States and allows US companies to start to become compliant with the European regulations. Without being part of the EU-US Privacy Shield, the United States is considered a third country because it's not felt to have adequate data protection or data privacy regulation without that piece. This is a little bit of a bold statement, but I make it with the best of intentions and try to explain why. But the GDPR may become the standard. The reason I say that is because the European Union has gone to great lengths to ensure that their residents' data is kept safe and it's only used for the purpose for which it was collected for. Now that means that if you are collecting data for to provide a service, you can't decide at a subsequent point to use that data for marketing, for example, without gaining the consent of the data subject, the people whose data you're actually using. So it's very important for organizations based in the US or other parts of the world to have a good understanding of what their requirements are in complying with the GDPR, particularly if you're selling services to European residents, okay? So those based within the European Union, of which there are 28 countries at the moment, soon to be 27 when the UK leaves the European Union, but at this point in time, there are 28 countries within the European Union. So if you're selling services to France or to Germany, then you need to make sure that you are compliant with the General Data Protection Regulation in order to collect data and to be able to process that. Now, the reason I believe that it's going to become the standard is not only because the reach is global for the GDPR, so irrespective of where you're based, you have to comply if you're collecting and processing that data, but it's also a very client-centric, it's a very customer-focused piece of regulation. And I believe, certainly with some of the bigger breaches that we've seen recently, with the likes of Equifax, for example, that residents of other countries, possibly the United States, for example, will start to ask for and expect organizations to treat their data in a similar fashion, and also have the requirements to notify them if there is a data breach within a far shorter period of time than has been common in some of the big breaches that have taken place so far. And I also cite the example here of the fact that the US takes it so seriously and the trade between the United States and Europe so seriously that they've implemented the EU-US Privacy Shield capability, which allows US organizations to become compliant or move along the path to compliance with the GDPR. So that's why I make that bold statement around why the GDPR may become the standard. I've already explained in some detail about the EU-US Privacy Shield. There's some more details here about how it works and also how organizations can become involved. But what I'd really like to get into is some of the major tenets of the Privacy Shield, because these are the types of things that organizations need to do in order to comply, and these map very neatly and nicely onto the General Data Protection Regulation as well, the European requirements. So I'll read out the key ones of these. The first pillar is the requirement for notice. Now, all of this slide that I'm talking to at the moment, slide 9 for those who are listening via podcast, is very much a bridge. I'll try to summarize as much as I can the key requirements. If you do want to read the full requirement, you should really go to privacyshield.gov and navigate through to the appropriate page on there. The link is on the slide deck in full, so you can navigate your way through. But I've tried to summarize as concisely as I can on this slide. So notice, the organization must give a good deal of information about why they're collecting the information from the individuals. Okay, and they must have information that links through to the DOC's Privacy Shield list, where that organization should be listed, and the details of the personal information that they're collecting, and the data subject's rights. So what action someone who's providing their data can take in order to establish what data is being kept, what personal data is being used, and how it's being used, and those kind of things. The second requirement is choice. The organization must provide individuals, the data subjects, with the ability to opt out when data is provided to third parties or for uses other than those that it was collected from. Now, the best practice here is actually to have it as opt-in rather than forcing people to opt out. Okay, in Europe, that's a requirement. Under the EU-US Privacy Shield, you can actually require people to opt out. So you can have them as a default as opted in for marketing purposes, for example, and have them opt out of that by unticking the box. You must also identify the onward transfer. So if you're using a secondary organization to process the data, and processing is quite a complex subject. It actually covers the entire life cycle of the data, right from collection through use and updating and maintenance and go through to archiving and ultimately through to destruction. All of that is considered to be processing. Okay, so you must be able to identify which third parties you're using to process this data, and they must be able to, must be held account to processing it in the way that is consistent with the purpose it was collected for. So just because the data is being passed on to a third party, they can't use it for marketing purposes, or they can't use it for marketing of your organization on your behalf, because if the data subjects have said that they didn't opt into that. So that full chain there must be maintained, and the use of the data and the reason for its collection must be fully respected. The fourth principle is that organizations must maintain good security. They must take appropriate actions and reasonable actions to ensure that the data isn't misused, that it can't be easily breached or lost or used for other purposes other than those that it was collected for. Okay, and that again goes right the way through the life cycle of the data processing. Data integrity is the fifth principle. That means that the data can only be used again for the purpose it was collected for, and only retain for as long as is reasonable. So that means that if you're part of an HR organization, for example, that means that you can't collect the resumes of those individuals who applied for jobs, and you can't keep those resumes for 20 years, for example. Most organizations, that would be considered an unreasonable period of time to maintain or keep keep personal data of that type. If there's a good reason for it and it's a justifiable reason, then that's absolutely fine. And likewise, if you're making the data subjects, the individuals whose data it is, if you're making them aware of the fact that it's going to be kept for that period of time and they're comfortable with that, again, that's okay too. But you have to be able to defend the duration that you're maintaining the data for, and you must have good destruction capabilities and be able to evidence all these things too. The sixth principle is access. So individuals must have access to the personal information that is maintained and collected and processed by an organisation. Individuals have the right to actually request a list of the data and details of the data, the personal data that is being kept by an organisation. Under the GDPR, that's called a subject access request, and there are timescales under which that data has to be provided. So the request must be answered within a certain duration. And the final principle under the US Privacy Shield requirement is ensuring that there are robust mechanisms and controls in place to ensure that all of these principles are adhered to. And these are enforceable under US law. So once you sign up to the EU-US Privacy Shield, whilst it's an optional it's an optional piece of legislation that you're signing up to, once you do so, it is actually contractual, and you can actually be prosecuted then under US law for not actually following the framework. So it's something that organisations need to think carefully about before they go ahead and do that. But if they're if you're an international organisation and dealing with the European Union and residents within the EU, then you should very much be looking at that and considering that as a requirement. So I've talked a little bit at a high level about the European General Data Protection Regulation. Let's get into some of the headlines and some of the details of what GDPR means. So here we've got four high-level headlines. GDPR applies to organisations irrespective of their location if they are collecting, storing, or otherwise processing personal or sensitive information about EU residents. And this includes processing within the United States. GDPR will apply to UK-based companies irrespective of Brexit. So if you have a branch of your organisation that's based in the UK, don't think just because the UK is coming out of the European Union that they won't have to apply to GDPR. The UK government has already said that they fully support GDPR, and data protection will continue at the same level and the same level of equivalence. Now, here's the teeth of GDPR, and this is why organisations around the world are concerned and taking more notice of GDPR than perhaps they may have done with our previous data protection regulation. The fines for non-compliance can be as high as 20 million euros, or 4% of annual turnover, whichever is the higher. Okay, so if your organisation is a smaller organisation, it may be that 20 million euros would be the maximum fine. If you are a multi-billion dollar company, then it could be as high as 4% of your annual global turnover. And for those of you in the US, 20 million euros is a current exchange rate, around about $24 million. Okay, so it's GDPR has some teeth. And then final headline here, GDPR will be enforced from May 25th, 2018. So it's not too far away now. What are we now? Probably about 7 months away from that. Fifth step is very often asked for this kind of high-level view of should an organisation or will an organisation have to implement GDPR? So we put together this very high level view, and as I say on the bottom of the slide, This is a very summarized diagram, and you really shouldn't use this to completely replace a formal assessment process. But it is used as a guide, or can be used as a guide. So there are five questions that I pose here in order for you to understand whether you're going to have to be compliant with the GDPR. So is your organisation based in the EU? Does it have staff in the EU? Does it offer services to EU residents? Does it process EU personal data? Does it plan to do any of these things in the future? So if you're answering no to all of those questions, then you probably don't have to comply with GDPR. If you answer yes to any one of those questions, then you probably do have to comply with GDPR. There are some exceptions to that, but on the whole, you're probably going to have to comply. So this is a very high-level diagram, but I think you get the gist of what it's trying to convey. As with the principles for the EU-US Privacy Shield, I've laid out some of the key terms and terminology. Now, I've already been using some of these, but I'll run through these just because they are so important to understand. And they're not particularly difficult concepts once you understand them, but if you're reading about GDPR or you're reading about data privacy in other locations, very often these terms will be used. And if you haven't read this quick glossary or listened to the explanations, then it can be a little bit more confusing than it need be. So the concept of a data controller. A data controller is the personal company who determines the purpose and manner of processing of the personal data. Okay, so it's the body who is responsible for the data. Now that may be, in most of the clients that we're talking to, that's the actual organization themselves. Okay, so you have a company that is offering a service to individuals, it's their company themselves who are the data controller, because they are saying, we are collecting your data for the purpose of offering our service. Data processor is a third party to the data controller, and if you outsource some of your data processing, that third party that you outsource to would be considered a data processor. Okay, so data processing, as I've mentioned a couple of times, is anything to do with the collection of or processing of data, right from you're collecting it, storing it, manipulating, reporting upon it, deleting it, updating it, any of those kind of things are all considered to be data processing. So any of those aspects, if you have a third party doing that, then they are a data processor, and they have to follow the same rules as the data controller. Now, interestingly enough, under GDPR, the data controller remains responsible for the data irrespective of who they provide that data to. So if they give it to a third party and that third party has a data breach, the data controller is still liable for that breach and still responsible for that breach, still has to perform the data breach notification process, for example. Consent is a really important aspect under the GDPR. Each data subject, so the individuals providing the data, must be given very clear information about what the data is going to be used for, and they must consent to its use before that information is provided. So you can't collect the data and then say, oh, we're going to email you a list of the ways that we're going to use this data. It needs to be provided up front, and the consent should be positive consent, i.e. opt-in. Now, there are some circumstances, and they probably go beyond the bounds of what I'll cover today in this webinar, but there are some exceptions to having to provide that information up front. But if you can provide that information up front, you really need to be doing so. So if you're considering, oh well, that would be very difficult for us, then we would really very much need to go into a little bit more detail. Okay, the purpose for which the data is collected is very important as well. You can't clearly communicate why the data is being used and how it's being used without a purpose. So having a clear purpose that's in plain English or French, if it's targeting French data subjects, for example, but a clearly written and clearly communicated purpose is very important. Now, none of this would exist without the concept of personal data. So the concept of personal data is anything that is able to identify an individual. And this includes things like bank codes or account bank account numbers, credit card numbers, even IP addresses are now considered to be personal information under the GDPR. So make sure that you understand what the concepts of personal data are. It's not just name, address, email address, telephone number, or anything like that. It is a similar definition in some respects to PII under that's a term that's commonly used in the United States, for example, but it's not exactly the same. It's any data that can be used to identify an individual. So even if it's just a passport number is the only thing you're collecting, that is the sort of data that you're going to need to treat as personal data. And then we move on to personal sensitive data. Now, this is a special classification of personal data, and it tends to cover the type of data which has previously been used to persecute people in the past. So it may be about racial or ethnic information or details, political opinions, trade union membership, psychological or mental or mental health and things like that, and religious beliefs of all types. Criminal history is also covered, and new to the GDPR is the concept of biometric and genetic information also being considered to be sensitive information. Now, I'm sure we'd all agree that that's perfectly right that information should be gathered there, but there are many organisations who are now having to add new processes and procedures because of that that additional information. Okay. Let's move on to the next slide. Okay, so I give the full definition here of what personal data means. I gave the high level there. I won't go into the full detail here, but it is included in the slide deck, so it does give you the full verbatim description of what personal data means. But essentially, it's any information that can be used to identify a living individual. One question that I get asked a lot when I'm talking, particularly to senior executives and board members, there's sometimes a confusion that GDPR covers only digital data, so any data that can be stored on a hard drive or on a computer. Actually, it covers all information, so that's printed documentation that's held in a filing cabinet is all actually covered by the GDPR. So don't think that it's just data that's held in a database or within a Word document, for example. That's not the case. I also include the personal sensitive data definition as well. I've gone into that in some detail, but it is useful to have that there as a summary for you if you're dealing with the implementation of GDPR. The importance of the data collection purpose is our next slide here. So it's very important that any individual who's providing their data has a clear understanding of why the data is being collected. And as I said earlier, that needs to be in plain language, no legalese, very plain as to what the data is being used for, who's going to be using it, if it's going to be processed outside of the European Union or the Extended Economic Area, the EEA, which includes Switzerland. If it's going to be processed outside of that region, then that needs to be made clear to the data subject before they actually provide the data, so that they can decide, actually, I don't want my information going to Argentina, or actually Argentina would be okay because that's considered an equivalency country, but I don't want my information going to China, for example. I actually would rather use another service that doesn't send my data to China for processing. These are the high-level rights of the data subject. So I'll run through what these actually mean, and I will do that at a high level. And you can read more about this, both within the slide deck, but also there's lots of information, including on the Fifth Step website, and I'll provide details of that at a later date. But I'll run through these with some pace. The right to be informed is the first right of the data subject. Now, the rights of the data subject are there for data subjects to be able to enforce any time after the data has been collected, including a number of years later. Okay, so if you're holding data for 20 years, then the data subject has the right to ask any of these questions or enforce any of these rights at any time after the data has been collected. Okay, so the right to be informed, that really goes back to the purpose and the data collection purpose. So the data subject has the right to be informed about what the data is used for. The right of access, the data subject has the right to access the data that that you're holding on them, the personal data. So they can make a subject access request, as I described earlier, where you have to detail all of the information, the personal information and the personal sensitive information that you're holding about them. And obviously, all of these rights have to be rigorously enforced to ensure that the data subject is the person who's asking for the information, and the person asking for the information has the right to obtain that information. Otherwise, you could be perpetrating a data breach. The right to rectification is essentially the right for the data to be corrected. If a data subject asks for a copy of their data and establishes that you're actually confusing them with a relative or someone else who has a similar name who lives in the same area as them, then they have the right for that data to be corrected and that for that mistake to be corrected and put right. The right to erasure. I'm going to avoid making jokes about 1980s bands, one called Erasure, at this point in time. But the right to erasure is really the right to request that the data be deleted. Okay. Now, there are exceptions to this. If the data cannot be deleted for legal reasons, for example, the organization has the right to say, no, we can't delete that data. If the data requested is required for the provision of the service, then the organization has the right to go back and say, well, we can't delete this data and provide the service, in which case the data subject may obviously cancel the service and ask for the data to be deleted. But all of those rights exist. And again, and to reinforce, these rights exist from any time after the data has been collected. The right to restrict processing really comes back to if the data is incorrect or if the data is being used for a purpose other than what it was intended, you know, what the state of it was being collected for. So if the data is now being used for the provision of a service and for marketing, the data subject has the right to request that the data not be used for marketing because that's not what they signed up for. The right to data portability is a really interesting right. I think this is going to shake things up a little bit in a number of different sectors. But the right to data portability, it means that the data subject has the right to request their personal data in a machine-readable form, so in XML or a CSV file or some other industry-standard file type. And the purpose for that is obviously so they can provide it to another provider. So in my mind, I'm thinking about all of the insurance websites that you can go to and you can get your motor quote and you submit your details once. I think in future they're going to be asking for you to give them the right to ask for your data from your existing insurer so they can actually facilitate the movement between one provider and another provider. I'm sure that's going to increase their success rates and increase the commission that they're going to be looking for providing that service. The right to object, this one's quite closely linked, I believe, to the right to restrict processing. So a data subject has the right to object to their data being processed. So not only can they restrict processing, so they can say, well, you can continue to use it for this purpose, but not this purpose, they can object completely. Okay, that may be on the path to them asking for their data to be removed, or it may be that they're objecting because you're actually now using it for marketing purposes. You didn't say you were going to do that, and they're raising a formal complaint about that. And the final right is the right to manual processing. This, again, I think is going to shake things up in some areas. The example I tend to use here is for a bank, for example, that's offering mortgages to people. Very often these days, banks will use credit scoring and a number of our algorithms to actually go through, collect the data that you've provided, provide some analysis of that data, but ultimately it may be an algorithm that decides whether you're eligible for that mortgage or not. Now, under the GDPR, organisations based in Europe have to be able to provide the right to manual processing. Now, that means you have to be able to have a human being who can look at an individual case and say, I agree with the computer's assessment here, this is correct, they shouldn't be allowed a mortgage because of these reasons, or actually the computer's wrong in this instance and I overrule that decision by the computer, and therefore we will be providing a mortgage or offering a mortgage to this person. Now, the implications there are not only that you have to have the business processes to be able to support all of these rights, but particularly in this case, the right to manual processing, but your computer systems also have to be able to deal with the fact that you're going to have a process in place, an automated process in place, but it can be overridden at some point by a reviewer. It's a very important aspect, and one that I think many organisations are not fully aware of, and I think it will be challenged a number of times by individuals as they start to be rejected for automated mortgage offers, for example. Now, we spoke earlier on when I was talking about some of the other regulation around the world, we spoke about the need for a data protection officer. So the need for a data protection officer is a requirement, it's a stated requirement under the GDPR, as it is with a number of other pieces of regulation. I mentioned earlier on NYCRR 500, for example, which has a requirement for a CISO or CISO to be in place. So a data protection officer is responsible for all of those things that are listed there on the right-hand side, and I'll read those out for our podcast listeners. But they're responsible for the protection and accuracy of the data, for the data protection policies and procedures, for working with the data protection authority. So if you have a data breach, it's a data protection officer who has to notify the data protection authority, and they have to do so within 72 hours. They're responsible for any data protection issues. They're responsible for data categorization, and they're responsible for data retention adherence and the implementation of the policies around data retention too. So this can be a large requirement. Now, smaller organisations, you don't have to have a dedicated resource to this. It can be someone's part-time job. As long as it's a named individual, in most instances, that's going to be more than enough. Okay, but for larger organisations or mid-sized organisations, you are going to need to have someone who's responsible for this. They're going to need to be knowledgeable about what the requirements are. That too goes for the smaller organisations, but there may be enough training that for a smaller organisation you can do to cover it internally. But where that's not possible, there are organisations of which FISTEP is one of those organisations that provide data protection officer. FISTEP's a little bit unique in the way that we do that because we are able to do that as a flex up and flex down service, so a fractional and flexible service. If that's something that any of you guys listening or watching this are interested in, then do please reach out to me. I'm more than happy to run you through the benefits of that. Here's some high-level guidance about what to do next in respect to GDPR. This framework can very much be used for any data protection regulation around the world. Very much the requirements are very, very similar as you look around the world, and they're increasingly so. And that's not an accident. The data protection regulators are getting together. I'm sure they're very fun Christmas parties where they get together and they talk through the things that are working in their countries and things that aren't working and how they might work together differently, and make sure there's good crossover between the various regulation around the world. So this list can be used not only with the GDPR, but it can be used with other regulations. So the first step, data categorization and data flow. So understand what personal data you're collecting, how it's flowing, how is it being collected, where is it going to, you know, which third parties is it going to, and things like that. Checking your policies, processes, and procedures against the regulation you're looking to comply with. So if that's GDPR, look at the GDPR requirements. Are your policies, processes, and procedures actually helping you comply and helping you demonstrate your compliance? Making sure that your computer systems have the ability to fulfill all the data subjects' rights. So are your computer systems actually helping you comply, or are they actually hindering you? You know, perhaps it's not possible to delete some of the data from your databases. Have you got a data incident response plan? So if there is a breach, have you got a plan that you can execute right now that says what you would do, who you would contact, how you would go about stemming the flow? You know, if you actually discover you're having a breach whilst the data is being stolen, do you know what to do? Do you know who you would contact? If you're in the United States, for example, the breach requirements between states vary, and the timescales that you have to adhere to vary. But in the United States, you also have to notify law enforcement too. So look at those kind of things. Have you got that incident response plan? Under the GDPR and under NYCRR 500, you have to be able to respond within 72 hours. Okay, not the 6 months that Equifax took or the 4.5 years that Yahoo took, 72 hours. It's a real, you know, this is going to shake things up in terms of organizations having to be able to respond to a data breach. Now, that's 72 hours from the point of notification. It's not, you know, if you're hacked 6 months ago and you find out about it today, and the clock starts running from the point of discovery. Obviously not from the point of breach. Understand any geographic requirements and restrictions. Understand, can you export the data? Where can you export it to? Do you need contractual agreements with organizations in countries outside of Europe, for example? Or you know, in the case of the United States, is the organization you're sending the data to part of the EU-US Privacy Shield agreement? And finally, I'm a big fan of continual improvement and making sure that you're maintaining your compliance. None of these things are a one and done. They're really not. It's not a project. It's a project to get it implemented, but then you need to come back and you need to revisit these things to make sure that your organization hasn't changed around the regulation, or the regulation hasn't changed around your organization. So implement a continual improvement process. Regulators tend to love this kind of stuff too, because it allows you to demonstrate to them that you've actually got a process to log any shortcomings that you've got at the moment. Obviously, if there's serious flaws, you should be dealing with them. But where there are items that you've noted for improvement in the next cycle, regulators tend to love that kind of stuff. So we're going to start moving into questions and the Q&A piece now. So if there's any questions that you've got, then I'm more than happy to take those as we move through, and I'll just flip through these next couple of slides as people start to ask those questions. I've spoken about the Data Protection Officer service. The details are in the slide, but come to the Fifth Step website, and I'm more than happy to talk you through that, talk about the benefits of that to your organisation. If you're really keen, I've written a book about GDPR, and it's available on the Amazon store. I would love for you guys to read it and give me the feedback and the thumbs up, or indeed some areas where you think it needs some more coverage. It's called The Little Book of GDPR because it is only a little book, though. So it covers in more depth some of the details we've covered today. And if you want to know it even more, come back to the Fifth Step website, listen to our podcasts, and watch our videos. So if there's any questions, I'm more than happy to answer any of those questions now.
I have a comment, Darren. Well, thank you very much for this presentation. I think that was eye-opening, at least for me, despite the fact that I'm dealing with the international issues day in, day out. They are related to benefits, and sufficient to say that we're exchanging a lot of data pretty much on a daily basis, and I may confess that probably we're taking a little bit the data privacy situation lightly than we should have, and it was kind of interesting to know how things are varied based on the different country situations, and we work with partner brokers in those countries like China, Australia, Argentina, and other 160 countries around the world, but that was kind of very interesting to see how in different countries situations are dealt differently on this subject of data privacy and data governance. And never we thought that something like that would come to existence. 24 years ago, when Globex came to existence itself, granted, the world is coming more global on an everyday basis, but the issues that we have to deal over the couple years related to the data privacy and all other issues related to the subject of the presentation is really staggering. Thank you very much. That was a very interesting presentation, and we will definitely have a different look at all the issues that presented in your great presentation.
Well, thank you very much. That's really kind feedback. I really appreciate it. And, obviously, if you've got any questions, do come back after the event. And for anyone listening to the podcast or indeed watching the video presentation of the webinar, the recording, do come back, ask the questions. I'm always open to answering questions for people who are trying to get this stuff implemented. And you can find me very easily from the Fifth Step website or on LinkedIn or on Twitter and things like that. And I do answer questions and try to provide the best feedback to those kind of things as I can. Because I understand how confusing it can be for people in different countries trying to implement this, and it can be confusing for everyone. Great. Well, Valentine, was there anything else that you wanted to say, or Priscilla, if there's any other questions from you? If not, I'm going to draw us to a close, and we'll get this webinar closed out and up onto YouTube and up onto the podcast channel.
Excellent presentation, Darren. Very informative, and I'll make sure and shoot you specific emails that any clients have in mind, and I really appreciate your time. This is great.
Thank you very much, guys.